This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents I Can't Date Jesus. Love, sex, family, race, and other reasons I've put my faith in Beyoncé. By Michael Arsenault. Read by the author.
Once an old high school classmate told me at the Papados off of 610 in Houston that I would end up working at Burger King because I had majored in journalism. This book is dedicated to dummies like that who don't know when to shut the hell up. Also, pay fast food workers livable wages. I know where I'm going and I know the truth, and I don't have to be what you want me to be. I'm free to be what I want. Muhammad Ali. But in the long run, no matter what I do for the rest of my life, I'll know I did something wonderful by saying what I felt. Fiona Apple. Introduction. Before that day, I hadn't been to church in 5 Beyoncé albums. Well, not for service anyway. In that span of time, I stepped inside 2 separate churches for 3 funerals, but as my mama and most faithful churchgoers will promptly make clear, solely stepping into the house of the Lord isn't the same thing as attending Mass or church service and truly engaging in praise and worship. Until that April morning, the closest I had come to church attendance was watching WeTV's Mary Mary, an eponymously titled reality series about that gospel duo, and body-rolling tracks of theirs like God in Me, but only the chopped and screwed versions because as a native of Houston, Texas, everything sounds better to me chopped and screwed, Jams for Jesus included. Other quasi-religious activities for my churchless life included posting contemptuous social media updates about the Baptist church across the street from my Harlem apartment and how the incredibly bad singing coming out of it is disrespectful to Jesus. Even if I had become an estranged acquaintance of Jesus, I didn't feel he deserved the shaky vocals having soloists and an equally terrible choir shouting off-key about Christ's love. If Jesus Christ was nailed to a cross in order to die for our sins, the least any church singers can do is find the correct note. I often describe myself as a recovering Catholic, but when a more pointed question such as, "So what do you believe in?" surfaces, I struggle with specificity. I know that I am not an atheist. For me, to let go of the idea of God altogether would mean completely sinking to a level of cynicism and jadedness that ultimately could devour me whole. This is not to speak for atheists in general. It's merely what an embracement of atheism would mean for me. I cling to the idea that there has to be something bigger than us. Perhaps God is not, as he is so often depicted, the old white man with a white beard, as long as a freshly sewn in 22-inch Peruvian body wave human hair weave. Maybe God is not a man at all. Over time, I've grown weary of using male pronouns to denote that divine being. In all the years of my absence from God's house, I've continued to fall to my knees, sometimes on a random sidewalk, to pray, if for no other reason than to leave some line of communication open. As for Jesus, I swung back and forth from "that's my nigga" to treating him like a friend with whom I've fallen out with because I hate a lot of his punk-ass friends, e.g. so many Christians, and never really had a proper sit-down with him to make amends. Many with a firmer stance about their religion have mocked or at least expressed befuddlement at those who say they are more spiritual than religious. It is their belief that such a non-committal position reads as lazy, like it's putting the tip in with respect to faith, but not really going all the way. For them, it's merely a matter of effort. You can do it, put your back into it. Such opinions are a reflection of their own lack of will to step outside of themselves and their experiences and see how those on the other side feel. How can you be obedient to dogma you found oppressive? How can you cling to tradition and exalt a vision of God that minimizes you and expects you to suppress what is innate to you? Is it not an exercise in futility to place your faith in a belief system that doesn't completely believe in you? Some of us either do not know the answers or have found ones that leave us on our own respective journeys for clarity and understanding, independent of any organized religion. It may not be a definitive position, but there are periods in life during which a gray area may be best. For those who do not understand or refuse to understand, such is their right. They also have the right to mind their own damn business. Anyway, in the midst of this cloudiness over my religious ID, I found my way back inside of church to attend service. Naturally, I would go on Easter Sunday, one of three specific days when a bevy of lay Christians or full-fledged heathens opt to go check in with God. The other two are Christmas and Mother's Day. Funnily enough, there was no grandiose moment that got me back inside of a church for the first time in well over a decade. It was just a simple request from my best friend Andre. He prefers the aesthetic of lowercase lettering, and I respect it. Dre and I were at brunch a week before, and he asked me if I wanted to go to church with him on Easter. I don't recall what number Bellini I was on, but I was of sober mind when I replied, sure. Now, for years and years, my mother had been encouraging me to go back to church. The most opportune times for her to push her agenda were whenever I felt my lowest. My mother may not have always seen me as holy as I would have liked, but she was one of the very few people who could see through my veneer, a person who knew that beneath the flexes of strength and feigned indifference to a hostile world was a man often struggling to hold it together. In these weak moments of mine, she would push me to go back to God's house to renew my faith and, by extension, be in a better place in every facet of my life. I like my methods better. Mary J. Blige albums and maybe another prescription to a generic form of Celexa. After a while, she did take the hint that I was as firm in my choice not to go as she was in hers that I ought to. She would continue to encourage me to pray, send rosaries and prayer books, and sometimes casually mention that I might want to tip my toe into God's residence. But in time, she majorly fell back. She wanted the best for me. She loved me. She just didn't understand that what she wanted from me was not for me. Her technique always made me think of this line for Pimpsy on UGK's High Life. Tired of hearing grandma telling me, when you gonna go to church, Chad? Dre was different in that he understood my conflicting feelings about religion based on my sexuality better than most did, even if he didn't handle them in the same way. He was a preacher's kid, but he was neither rebellious toward the faith nor didactic in how he discussed it with other people. As for the church he invited me to, First Corinthian Baptist Church in Harlem, I had heard about it and its well-regarded pastor, Michael A. Rawlin Jr., better known as Pastor Mike, repeatedly since I had moved to Harlem some 4 years prior. Despite constantly hearing about how great he was, I had never received a direct invitation from him to see for myself. So when Dre actually did extend a direct invitation, I accepted and went to church with him the following week. I grew up Catholic, so a lot of traditions associated with the black church were much different from what I was used to. For example, I could just as easily have worn jeans as I did slacks if I went to church. Outside of major holidays, I never had to dress to impress anyone at the Catholic churches in Houston that I attended. I simply just needed to be present. And one thing I did like about Catholicism was that Catholics were big fans of brevity. A typical Mass was no longer than an hour, and even on holidays like Easter and Christmas, it extended to no more than 90 minutes. On the other hand, my only other recollection of attending a Baptist service was being in church for what felt like an entire weekend. Thankfully, Dre explained to me that I could wear denim and a button-up and that the 9:30 service wasn't going to be too long because there was another one at 11:30. He and a few of his friends casually referred to the 11:30 service as thought service. I'm not entirely sure why. I'm assuming it's because it's the latest service and catered to the night owls who needed a bit more time to recover from the previous evening. But all I knew was that it was the longest service, so absolutely not the one for me. 2 hours of church service sounds like 2-for-1 mass to this old Catholic. Nope. I actually got to church before Dre, and he found me in line to get in. There were 2 separate lines. One was for the regular parishioners, most of whom were black, and the other one was largely for white European tourists. It looked like segregation, only the So-So Def remix in which black people had decidedly more power over the space. I would later find out that there were plenty of black tourists in the same line as I was, but the optics were striking all the same. While waiting to be let inside, I came across a media legend whose work I had long admired and whom I knew socially. He showed visible shock when he made eye contact with me, then came up to me and quipped, "Oh honey, don't burn the church down." Ah, joke with a tablespoon of judgment. I was indeed back in church. Praise the Lord. At least he didn't greet me with "fancy seeing you here, fornicator." Clearly rusty on how to enter a church, much less one of this size, I grabbed my wallet and was about to pull out my ID to show it to the usher that stood before the doors. Yes, as if he were a club bouncer. Yes, as if I were trying to get in free before 11 and rush to the bar to enjoy that 2-for-1 drink special. I believe God has a sense of humor, so I'd like to think he saw that moment and said, "This ridiculous bird-ass bitch." Once I stepped into that sprawling, gorgeous space, I marveled at its beauty, but the images that stuck with me most were of the people sitting inside. I saw a woman that I knew was married to another woman. Directly behind me was another gay man I knew. I ended up sitting between two gay men. All of them were regular attendants, yet none of them appeared torn about being there. Of course, there have always been gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and trans people inside churches. But although their talent might be on display in, like, say, the choir, their sexuality was far less pronounced. As in, don't ask, don't tell, just sing your little gay self off for God. And indeed, I did clock plenty o' gays in the First Corinthian choir. But this felt different from what I was accustomed to. I knew what it was like to be around Christians who knew of my sexuality, but who merely tolerated me. Tolerated meaning they knew I was gay, but avoided the subject at all costs. There was a difference between being welcome and being tolerated. Here, everyone, and I mean everyone, seemed to be welcome and behaved as such. In the front row, which was reserved for other pastors of the church, I saw a sea of women. Women were typically marginalized out of leadership roles in the church. In Catholicism, no such roles even existed. But here, on this day, and in this church, there were more women pastors than there were male pastors. When Pastor Mike spoke, I understood quickly why so many people had fawned over him for so long. With respect to various members of the clergy, having read the Bible didn't mean you actually understood it. There was memorization and repetition, and then there was comprehension. During service, they called on those who were visitors to stand. I did so reluctantly. Toward the end, they called on those who wanted to join the church to step down and approach the altar. I kept my black ass in my seat. Let's not get ahead of ourselves, saints. I ended up interviewing Pastor Mike for a work-related project a few weeks later. I asked him why LGBTQ SWV folks felt so welcome. I added SWV to honor both the girl group and the expanding identities. I'm also a smartass. He said it was because they were welcome, that he was not condemning who they were, that he had not been placed in that pulpit to make them feel less than or like an affront to God. He also agreed with what I meant about many people in the clergy not necessarily being theologians and thus having a limited understanding of the text they were supposed to be teaching to parishioners. Biblical literacy of convenience irked the living hell out of me, I told him. We both likened the situation to various cable pundits who didn't know so much about policy but were adept at repetition and talking points. Seeing how moved I had been during the service, one of Dre's friends suggested that I write about it. As a freelance writer, the constant essay hustling had me always in a state of planning for the sake of a paycheck, but that was not why I had come, so I brushed the idea off. I had gone simply because I had been invited, I told him. In hindsight, the invitation had come at the time when I was truly ready to accept it. After service, Dre and I hopped in an Uber to join friends for brunch. I told Dre that I enjoyed my time there and that I would go back, but I made clear that I wasn't joining the church. Frankly, while I had enjoyed my time there, in terms of what I believed in, or in my case, didn't believe in, nothing changed. There was no moment that compelled me to re-enter a relationship with Christianity. It felt good, but not that good. What I will say, though, is that what I saw at First Corinthian in Harlem was the Christianity I wish I had as a child, as a teenager, and as a young man trying to find a place in a world that appeared unwilling to offer one. This was the Jesus I had needed to see back then. These were the Christians I had needed much earlier in my life. Maybe if I had found a church and pastor like this, my views on religion might be different. Perhaps questions about the state of my Christianity wouldn't require me to first locate a feather duster. Yes, I was moved by what I had seen and heard, but I had already moved beyond needing a church and a member of the clergy to guide me to God or define my sense of what's right and wrong. In those years of separation, I created my own idea of who God is and what God means to me. The same goes for my moral compass. I've become a solo act when it comes to how I process things and what spirituality now looks like. And I'm wary of walking back to the old band whose validation I have long moved past requiring, as I simply do not need it. Months later, someone from St. Mark the Evangelist, the church I attended regularly as a child, with whom I went to catechism, think Vacation Bible School for Baptists or the weird thing they do for entry-level Scientologists, reached out to me via Facebook. She had watched an interview in which I described myself as a recovering Catholic. She told me, "Michael, you have tears in my eyes with your video posts. I had no idea you felt that way about being Catholic. It really hurt to hear you say you were recovering from it. She went on to tell me that she understood where I was coming from, and she shared a story about her guilt over perceived faults she had committed in the past. These faults, though, were simply the acts of a woman with autonomy over her body. Not abortion, not that it matters, but a medical procedure that she would later learn was considered to be a sin. She spoke of extreme depression as a result of the guilt stemming from her decision, but ultimately, a priest told her during confession that she had already been forgiven, that she merely needed to forgive herself. She told me this as a means of reaching out to me and to let me know that I didn't have to feel that way about the Catholic Church. She described the church as a big family, that we all had different opinions, that we loved each other, and that the church we both grew up in was different now, that it was welcoming, and that she could actually see and feel the love. She made it sound a lot like 1 Corinthians. Unfortunately, her telling me this story did not warm me back to the Catholic Church or any church. All she did was remind me of what had kept me away for so long. When she admitted that she continued to feel guilty after all this time, I told her therein lay the problem, that there had never been a reason for her to feel guilty. She told me I could be a returning Catholic and free of guilt, but she wasn't even free from hers. Her efforts were well-intentioned, but not at all convincing. I didn't doubt her when she said our church had changed, but I had long ago decided not to wait for any individual church or institution to change. To put the fate of my sanity in either was too great a risk. I needed to find my own moral compass. I needed to develop my own understanding of my place in the world and my right to be exactly who I was and how that related to God. To do it on my own was a far more difficult task, but the time away had me much more comfortable with myself. This book is about unlearning every damaging thing I've seen and heard about my identity and allowing myself the space to figure out who I am and what that means on my terms. I may not have figured every single thing out, but I do know the stories I heard as a child and the damnation assigned to me because of my identity no longer haunt me. I do know that I am a good person. Most of all, I know that God gave us the gift of discernment and that I've made the most out of it. I'm glad that I did not merely give in to deference because it may have very well been the death of me. Being able to step back inside of a church that truly lived up to Christian virtues was refreshing, but I'm reminded by another openly homophobic church only a few blocks from where I live now that this is still not the case for all. The same can be said of a childhood friend being stricken with the level of guilt only a religious institution can instill. Still, for a brief moment on Easter Sunday 2017, 15 years after essentially abandoning Christianity in an act of self-preservation, I was able to experience it the way I wish I always had. I do not know what my future with religion looks like. I don't see myself becoming saved by 40 and releasing a trap gospel album soon after, but stranger things have happened. Whatever does happen, though, I know that with or without it, I'll be fine. If it can boost my life, great, but if not, I'll at least continue giving Jesus the courtesy of condemning anyone who can't sing for him in the correct key. Amen. The first taste. Shh, be quiet. If they hear us, we'll get in trouble. That's what 5-year-old me whispered to the boy in the cot next to mine. I don't remember his name, but I'll never forget the feeling he gave me. He was tickling me, which sounds innocent on the surface, but the spots on my body where he attempted to tickle me made it anything but. Typically, you tickle someone to make them squirm for the sake of laughter. Yet the touching felt tantalizing. Its intentions different. So was my reaction. We may have snickered as we touched each other, but it wasn't so much comical as it was two little boys letting their curiosity get the best of them and enjoying a new and perplexing but nonetheless exciting feeling. I've never been one to nap, which meant that I spent much of the designated nap time at daycare doing something else, and that something else usually centered on an inappropriate touchy-feely game with other boys. I can't even recall how the game began. It just sort of did. And obviously, I had a favorite boy with whom I'd play the game. Fun came at a price, however, if you were caught. Such was the case for two other boys who had once been spotted moving a wee bit too feverishly underneath the covers. I couldn't see exactly what they were doing, since they were a few feet away, but I could make out the laughter that came as a result of it. Apparently, so could one of the daycare workers. After hovering over them for a minute or so, she quickly ordered them both to rise and follow her, no doubt to call their respective parents. I once faced a similar scenario after I was caught behind the playground near the air conditioner, pulling my pants down in front of another boy, who soon followed suit. It was like Show and Tell the remix. Mrs. Rhodes, who ran the daycare, was not impressed with our take on that familiar pastime, however. Once Mrs. Rhodes found us, it didn't take long for the tears to flow from my eyes. So afraid was I of what was coming next. I knew that I enjoyed what I was doing, but I also knew that others, namely my parents, wouldn't share my enthusiasm. So, I opted to make myself look as pathetic as possible in hopes of being granted mercy. I cried every drop I could get out in order to prevent Mrs. Rhodes from telling my mother I had misbehaved. With such natural acting ability on display, it's no wonder Mrs. Harris would later cast me in the lead role of the play, Lil' Red Goes to the Hood, a few years later. As a child, I had the reputation of being sneaky in my family. I personally didn't think of myself as sneaky, but everything I had just described was some sneaky shit. Perhaps a little manipulative to boot. The goal was simply not to get a whooping or be put on punishment. That near chance of my mom finding out what I was doing on her dime at daycare spooked me, but it was still not enough to suppress my burgeoning curiosity. Instead, I was just more careful and a lot less audible. Sometimes I debate whether I'm violating child pornography laws while recalling my own childhood. But none of my actions were really all that different from those of the other kids who played doctor. This was the same game, only with the same sex spin. Besides, kids of opposite sexes got in trouble for getting frisky with each other too. We were all a little inquisitive in hell, Barney and Friends was born. I did try my naptime shenanigans with a girl once. It was about as much fun as singing along to a dancing purple dinosaur. As a young adult, I read an interview that Janet Jackson gave to the now defunct Blender magazine in 2004. In it, she discussed having a sense of her sexuality very early. As I've gotten older, I've come to realize that I had a very active sexual mind at a very young age, she explained. I hope that doesn't sound bad. She went on to add, when you're a kid, you have little fantasies, but I saw myself being with Barry Manilow as an adult, not as a kid. So, while Janet is a better singer, shut up, she can sing, dancer, and recording artist, sadly my rap career remains a figment of my imagination, than me. I can confidently claim that my taste in men might be superior, cause girl, Barry Manilow? Who fantasizes about Barry Manilow besides middle-aged moms who can't clock their fellow queens? And just picture an adult Janet Jackson having sex with Barry Manilow. Actually don't, especially if you wear contact lenses, as that would be a waste of a perfectly good pair. Different strokes indeed, sis. Thanks to that interviewer, though, I realized that I wasn't some loose kindergartner. I was just exploring my natural urges like Janet had. I'm like Janet, but before the Super Bowl. I've never been able to find a space in which I could talk about these events that felt free of judgment or presumption. No, I was never molested. Yes, every boy back then was a willing participant. Why was I doing it? I'm not sure, but it happened. I don't regret it. Still, back then I had no name to call these feelings that I had for other boys. At that time in my life, I had not yet heard labels like gay, bisexual, or queer. It took the death of a relative from a then controversial disease to both enlighten and terrify me. And the term that did awaken was a slur that had stayed with me for much of my life. I don't remember much about my Uncle Daniel. I've never been particularly close to my dad's side of the family, as he never has been either. I have no recollection of what my paternal grandfather looked like. And while I would see some of his brothers and sisters, depending on the year and the holiday, I remember nothing about Daniel. Not a single thing other than how he died. My sole memory of him is seeing him at peace during his funeral mass at St. Francis Xavier in Houston on Reed Road. It was not my home church, but it was one of the few that remained predominantly black and was near my paternal grandmother's house. No side of my family started in Texas. They all came from Louisiana, and with them the Catholic faith most of them were raised in. Many would come here, then as adults go off and turn to a Christian denomination better suited for them. And there, inside that quaint Catholic church, I accompanied my mother to the front of the altar and started to sob hysterically after looking into Daniel's open casket. Yes, I had cried at the daycare to get myself out of trouble, but I typically hated crying in general. To be fair, though, I was a child standing before a corpse. I seized the moment. My mother was the one who later explained his death to me. She told me that my uncle, her brother-in-law, had died of something called AIDS. With it being only 1990 and drugs having ravaged the black community throughout much of the previous decade, his death signaled an opportunity to instill a valuable lesson in me. Don't be like Daniel the heroin addict. See where drugs can lead you. My dad didn't want me to be like Daniel either, though he said in another way, "Fuck that faggot." He was in the midst of another drunken stupor. The con that went on and on into the night until he finally decided to shut up, go to his bed, and stay in it. My mom. "Don't listen to him, Michael. Daniel wasn't gay." I always took my mother's word over my father's, but something seemed amiss about what she had said in comparison to what he was screaming about. She didn't sound like she really believed what she was saying. She seemed uncomfortable, as if she had something to hide. Say, the truth that my dead uncle probably contracted AIDS from gay sex, sharing needles, or some combination of the two. So the truth needed to be scaled back a bit. I was a child, after all. There was only so much my inquisitive but young mind could probably grapple with. So perhaps with my benefit in mind, she explained death in much tamer terms. It was easier for both of us that way. Yet my father's screams of faggot only intensified as the night went on. Those screams are what I'll never forget. That slur is what will always hit me in the pit of my stomach. Faggot, faggot, faggot. And on he went about what a faggot his dead brother was. The reasons why my uncle had never come around became clearer. My father had a habit of disclosing information about a given person or situation he otherwise opted to forego discussing whenever he had too much beer or brown liquor. This is what I discovered what it meant to be different and how some people might react to it. More important, this is how I learned how being different could lead to your demise. "I told you about sex when you were 3, my mother once explained to me matter-of-factly. This made perfect sense because even as a young child, I couldn't recall a time when I didn't understand the mechanics of sex, or at the very least, the context of where babies came from. My mom may have been a devout Catholic, but she was also a registered nurse who took care of new mothers. Sex was a fact of life, so she made sure I knew about it. Nevertheless, it wasn't until Daniel and my dad's tirade that I learned that when two people of the same sex touched each other, it could lead to death. Moreover, no matter how you were, there was certain behavior that could ostracize you, even from those that were your own blood. Those lessons were ingrained in me traumatically, and they only got worse as I aged and began to hear other words like sissy and punk. They all meant the same thing. They all made me trace myself back to those cots and what I had done in them underneath the covers. They all made me petrified. The same went for religion, which became further indoctrinated in me over time. As a result of all this, the games I used to play had to stop. The older I got, the more pressed I became about beating it. It was so much easier said than done. For starters, I couldn't even masturbate to girls. Visions of Janet Jackson's dancer Omar Lopez were far more stimulating than the thought of Miss Jackson herself. My young penis didn't seem to care how nasty she was. Lil' Kim's infamous promotional poster for her debut album Hardcore, where she squatted in a leopard bikini, did not have the same effect on me as the rapper Mace did, or Silk the Shocker, and definitely not Will Smith, any hour on any given day of the week. I fought and I fought. I would lie in bed so many times telling myself, "Think of a woman, think of a woman." It would work a few times, but mainly my dick would turn into Play-Doh in protest. This essentially set the tone for failure after failure with girls from K-12. Things started off with Jessica, who assaulted me with her jacket as a means of declining my advances en route to recess. She was lucky I didn't bite her with my buck teeth, mean little heifer. With Lucy, I approached her in a way that nixed the chance of a zipper scratching my eye socket. I passed a classic note, "Do you like me, yes or no? Circle one." Lucy wrote back, "I like you, but only as a friend." In truth, most of the girls only liked me as a friend. No one had the language to write back, "Nigga, you gay," or "Beloved, you're a homosexual," or "Sis, stop this." In middle school, I was fat and growing tits as fast as the girls were. Nothing happened. Bless my heart. I didn't manage to have my first date with a girl until I was 17. I met Camille through a mutual friend, Nicole. Even though I had my license, I was not the best driver. Camille noticed this very early into our date. Fearing for her life, she offered a suggestion that came across as more like a demand. Let her drive. Being a gentleman without any money to settle the multi-million-dollar wrongful death suit her parents might have filed, I obliged. The date went okay for a boy who clearly liked other boys and was awkward as hell around women in romantic settings. That is, until we reached the part where I, the guy, was supposed to make a move. See, what happened was, I thought to do something, but I couldn't follow through. Not even because we had both just eaten at a Chinese buffet and neither of us were packing a mint. I was too intimidated and not interested enough to overcome my anxiety. Instead, I shook her hand. Smooth. I never heard from Camille again. There was also a girl who had the same last name as mine. My last name is semi-common in Houston and very common across Louisiana all the same. I tried to convince myself otherwise. She didn't like me in the end. It was for the best. I have no idea why I was trying to act out a Game of Thrones incest prequel. Another girl by the name of Reese didn't want to be my girlfriend, but she randomly yet graciously offered to help me in another way. We were sitting in pre-AP chemistry, and she was explaining to me how some football player had had the audacity to fuck her with his socks still on. Since I was a virgin, I assumed maybe his feet were merely cold. Sensing my naivete, she had pressed to see whether or not I had had sex yet. After I blurted out no, she quipped, "Oh, but you're so cute. I'll fuck you, Michael." As appreciative as I was for her offer of a mercy fuck, I declined. If I couldn't even force myself to try and kiss a girl on a date, I definitely wasn't ready to kiss another's crotch. I was beginning to think my curiosity about women had peaked when I still had baby teeth. That is, until I met Alicia. She was by far the most beautiful girl I had ever tried to pursue. Years later, she would go on to be a professional cheerleader for an NFL team. She was so gorgeous that I'm certain she could have landed one of those players as a husband had she put her mind and her walls to it. At one point, I believed I loved her. I believed it because for once I didn't have to force myself to be into her. With these feelings came the idea that maybe, just maybe, I had finally had a real shot at overcoming my nagging attraction to guys, including her ex-boyfriend. I wanted to make this work, so I did everything I could to try and get Alicia to like me back. For all my efforts, I felt as if she was into me, though for one reason or another felt like she was ashamed about it. I wasn't sure why exactly, but that was always my sneaking suspicion about her. Whatever it was, my feelings of her soured after she stood me up the day of the TRL tour. Not only was it disrespectful to me, but it was also offensive to the star of the show, Beyoncé. Who stands up Beyoncé? A damn fool. Making matters worse, Alicia was my ride. My mother was using a rental car while her car was in the shop. She didn't feel comfortable letting me drive the rented car with my name not being on the insurance. That, and she presumably knew I was lying when I said someone had hit the car when in actuality, my terrible driving ass had hit something. In my defense, my friend Kim had reassured me that I could make that turn. She was wrong, so wrong. Without a date and minus a ride, I frantically called everyone I knew, hoping I could find someone willing to be my chauffeur and guest in exchange for gas money and the chance to bask in Beyoncé's greatness with me. In hindsight, my known devotion to Beyoncé might have been why I wasn't having much luck with girls. At a hood-as-all-hell high school in a neighborhood where most of the boys' musical palettes dealt with subject matter involving swinging and banging, it probably wasn't the smartest move to note that while you did have an affinity for Southern rap, you could easily shift gears and sing along with the girls who bashed about bugaboos and boasted about being too bootylicious for you, babe. Even after all of this, I continued my pursuit of Alicia. After the seventh or so blow-off, though, I bought a clue, gave up, and placed myself on an indefinite break from dating girls. It just seemed fruitless. I couldn't get myself to kiss a girl or to have sex with one when she offered, and I failed at securing the heart of the one girl I had managed to care somewhat for without force. By the end of high school, girls were as intriguing to me as they had been on that cot more than a decade earlier. On top of that, for all the girls I pursued, there were probably at least two boys whom I found far more interesting. As a result, like many a gay, I used the internet to vaguely explore an unshakable feeling. And through AOL Instant Messenger, Yahoo Messenger, and the private sections of far too many message boards, I did the virtual equivalent of what I used to do in those cots during nap time. I tried to look at women in porn too, but arousal always required far more effort in comparison to feelings that were always innate and urgent. But while I was ready to finally give up on my pursuit of girls, I was not ready to go beyond that and finally move beyond adolescent sexual explorations with boys into a tangible same-sex encounter. I was physically ready for it, but mentally I was still caught up in the trauma of my childhood and the religion that told me that such a thing was an aberration of God's natural order. The way I was introduced to what it meant to be gay never left me. the death that seemed certain to come with it, that immediate resentment you were sure to face over it. None of that had been shaken yet. It didn't help that pop culture, the only point many of us have in which to see our true selves, offered no images that I could relate to growing up, and nothing that could lift me out of the dark side of the life that I experienced early. So all I knew was the death of Uncle Daniel, the death of Pedro Zamor from the real world, and the death of Andrew Beckett from the film Philadelphia. The only living images I could think of were Blaine Edwards and Antoine Meriwether, whose skits on In Living Color offer portrayals of gay black men that were cartoonish and buffoonish in nature. The same can be said of the author J.L. King, who helped spread the myth of the down-low brother that gave all of the women the AIDS with his secret gay rendezvous on an episode of The Oprah Winfrey Show. All the while, there wasn't sex ed in schools explaining to me that so long as I protected myself, I would be fine. The same went for what to actually do with these feelings and the mechanics behind them. I only knew what I had seen. And what I had seen was frightening and alienating. So I did just me, literally. I thought of members of the track team, or rather, every track team I had ever seen on TV. I thought of multiple rappers, singers, and actors. I thought of people I basically cyber-hold with on IM. Every once in a while, I'd push myself to make my penis rise at the thought of a woman. Eh. Masturbation was also considered a sin, but I rationalized my actions by telling myself that as long as I kept touching my own penis instead of someone else's, God wouldn't grab Moses' staff and knock the shit out of me with it. And T-Boz of TLC once released a pro-masturbation single entitled Touch Myself. It flopped everywhere else but on my personal CD player, and as a result, I relied on my right hand to keep me from living what I thought was the wrong way. The decision to sin as a solo artist, to oppose exploring my sexuality in more tangible ways, spurred unneeded misery for years to come. It only stunted my development and made me more anxious and, by extension, occasionally awkward around men. It's often said that knowing who you are, or at the very least, possessing a sneaking suspicion of such early in life, is a blessing. The people who share this sentiment need to write it on a piece of paper, ball it up, and then proceed to pour barbecue sauce all over it as they eat it. Early self-awareness is a blessing only if who you are comes with a support system and an education. If you don't have those, it's easy to find yourself feeling stuck and sullen. I learned a certain part of my identity very early, but it was met with a near instant confirmation of how unwelcome that part of my identity was to those surrounding me. I liked everything much better before all of this happened. When the look of a cute boy wasn't soiled by the sight of a man in a casket, condemnation for his actions afterwards, warnings of fire and brimstone, and images all conveying abnormality. That's why it was so easy for an innocent tickle to turn into something that taunted me far longer than it should have. That's why it was so easy to end up afraid. I wish I had been more daring. I don't like how long it took me to embrace who I was. I hate thinking that what happened to me at 6 stopped me from being the best hoe I could be in my teens and 20s. I try not to live with regret, but it's difficult not to reflect on what might have been every so often. But I have also learned that we deal with what we can, how we can, until we get better. It took longer than it should have to deal with my past because where I come from, we tend to let things linger and fester. We bottle things up until it eats us inside. Sometimes we rupture in rage. Other times we turn to vices to bury the pain from whatever images and events feel unshakable, despite the irony of us never confronting them head on. It was not the correct way, but it was the only way I knew until I was able to develop greater nerve and take greater control of my own destiny and challenge what had all been instilled in me. I longed for the moment when I could be with another guy in the dark, lie there, and play in peace. For all my fears about intimacy and death, what was really destroying me all that time was trying to live a lie. Something had to give. I see a priest in you. I learned to bow down to big baby Jesus early in life. My mother, a devout Catholic, had given my brother and me kid-themed Bibles to read, biblical cartoons on VHS to watch, and plenty of other religious-themed material to keep us abreast in all things Christ our Lord. When I say biblical cartoons, I mean exactly what it sounds like. I used to watch animated depictions like one centered on, say, Adam and Eve from the book of Genesis. Yeah, that adorable story about the time God created humanity and let us frolic around Earth butt naked with friendly wildebeest or whatever until his second human creation, Eve, couldn't keep her hands to herself and ate the fruit God had directly instructed her not to touch, as if it were his labeled lunch in the office refrigerator. The creators of these cartoons managed to leave out the way in which stories like these were used to subjugate women and promote patriarchy through history. Sure, the cartoons were just fine if you were into age-appropriate forms of indoctrination, but the storytelling and graphics were much sharper on Chip 'n Dale Rescue Rangers, G.I. Joe, and DuckTales. Woo! As for the religious-themed material, I'm referring to various cards depicting noted saints such as St. Michael the Archangel, St. Pio of Petrosyna, and St. Martin de Porres, the Jackie Robinson of Saints Y'all, among many, many others. These were akin to baseball cards. On the front, you would see an image with a respective saint doing something he was best known for. For example, the card with St. Michael featured him over the image of Lucifer, whose ass God commanded Mike to dropkick out of heaven. St. Martin de Porres appears solemn and black on his card. Imagine a box of Uncle Ben's rice, only with Ben looking sad because he knows he's about to consume so many carbs and summer's coming. Of all the prayers I read on those cards, it was St. Michael's prayer I remember best. St. Michael the Archangel, defend us in battle. Be our protection against the wickedness and snares of the devil. May God rebuke him, we humbly pray. And do you, O Prince of the Heavenly Hosts, by the power of God thrust into hell, Satan and all other evil spirits, who wander through the world seeking the ruins of souls. Amen. When I was a child, my mom used to say that I was named after St. Michael and St. Joseph. Indeed, my middle name is Joseph. Several years later, my sister told me a different story. You were named after Michael Jackson, she said. Apparently, mom had initially wanted me to be named after my dad, which would have made me Wilton Jr. But my dad hated his first name, and no one ever called him that. His middle name was Joseph, and to this day, I've still only ever heard him known as Joe, Jojo, or Doc. My sister, 9 years older than I, was eventually tasked with helping name me, and being a huge fan of the Jacksons, she took inspiration from them. I almost told them to name you Randy Jackson. I love my sister so much, but we would not be as tight as we are if my name were Randy Arsenault and I learned she was responsible for that act of inhumanity. While it seems that Miss Janet authorizes only Randy Jackson to speak to the press on her behalf, I deserve better than being named after a spare Jackson. I also don't want to share a name with the American Idol judge who abuses the colloquial usage of dog. He's a nice guy, but no. Besides, the only desirable Randy I've ever seen was Randy from Home Improvement. But he was white and probably grew up to be a Trump supporter. Regardless of where my name came from, my mom made sure religion had an overall dominance over us. And whatever access point she could find to talk more about religion, she would exploit. In addition to the religious cartoons and saint-focused cards, I was also given an idea of how players on the other team operated. Dr. Marlena Evans provided the most memorable example. My mom had my brother and me watch Days of Our Lives during the period in which the main character, Marlena, was possessed by a demon. My mom clearly felt that this would teach us about the bad spirits roaming the earth. So throughout this soap opera saga, I got an idea of what happens when the devil gets a hold of you. Similarly, I got an early preview of one of God's most unfortunate creations, a bugaboo. Seriously, why was Stefano D'Amara so damn pressed? Why couldn't the bastard just accept that Marlena didn't want him? He was rich and ready to trick. Were there no other attractive blonde women around who could give him what he so desperately wanted? If not for him and his pursuit of her, Marlena would have never had a demonic freak living in her body rent-free. Apparently, there were demons and bugaboos all around, so we needed protection. One method of protection came in the form of a scapular. A scapular is essentially two small pieces of cloth connected by a string that's worn like a necklace, only inside of your clothes. As it was explained to me, the Blessed Virgin Mary assured believers that whoever dies clothed in this scapular shall not suffer eternal fire. That's right. When it's time to check into the gates of heaven, all scapular wearers have to do is flash that bad boy in front of St. Peter as if it's a VIP wristband, and bam, they're in there. If a scapular helped boost my chances of strolling into heaven like George Jefferson moving on up to the east side, do you think a demon was going to be able to shimmy into me on earth? Mm-hmm. I never took my scapular off. A lifelong klutz, I even showered with it on because I was convinced I was going to slip and fall in there. No way was I going to risk dying in the shower and end up waiting in the general admission line for admittance into heaven, or end up like Marlena Evans. Plus, from what I had gathered through other required viewing in my home, those various Nostradamus-centered doomsday specials that NBC used to air, for example, we were only one bad person away from Armageddon. All that was left between us and fire on Earth was the third Antichrist attaining maximum power. Additional protection included getting on my knees every night and reciting my Our Father, Hail Mary, Glory Be, and Act of Contrition, not to mention my prayers to St. Michael the Archangel and, of course, the Christian Child's bedtime prayer, Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep. I regularly attended Catholicism's answer to Sunday school, Catechism, which paved the way to my First Communion and ultimately my confirmation, which was me making the choice to enter the church of my own accord. Yeah, when you're basically house-trained for well over a decade into a religion and a certain way of life, it's totally free will by the time you decide to join the church at 16 or 17. With my mother being so religious, you went to church every Sunday and every day that the Catholic Church had designated a holy day of obligation. There really was no other way to be. Well, there was my father, who stopped going to church years before I was born. His Sunday ritual consisted of going outside and popping open a couple of baker's dozens of beers while playing James Brown, Johnny Taylor, Tupac, and other CDs he picked up out of my sister's car. He was partial to Master P's Ghetto D album, as he screamed to random people about whatever he felt was going wrong in his life. He had a better song selection than the organist at church, but his version of spirituality didn't seem all that rewarding. By the age of 18, I could recall missing Mass only once, and even then, I, along with my brother and sister, had to get permission to do so. The reason we were given a pass was because it was a storm so significant, even by Houston standards, that it made no sense to go out with all that rain and all that thunder and lightning. Over time, my interest in faith grew beyond, I don't really have much of a choice now, do I? I wanted to be more engaged, albeit for my own selfish reasons. Jesus was sold to me like a bit of a superhero. Those cartoon depictions might have had something to do with that, leading me to think he could do anything for me so long as I was persistent. All it would take was a lot of prayer. This premise worked perfectly for me because I had so many requests for my super-duper savior. First, I wanted Jesus to get my father to curtail his drinking, which only made his character more choleric and, in turn, more susceptible to rage sessions that could turn violent. My request was based on the working theory that if he would calm the hell down, my mother would be far less stressed and kinder to her kids. He loved us, but the trauma he carried tormented all of us. Mom, of course, loved us, but she carried her own difficult past too. She was loving, though not always nice. Another appeal to Jesus was for some money to go around. My parents made sure we were clothed and fed, and definitely went above and beyond to get us many of the things I nagged them for. Cable, so I could watch professional wrestling pay-per-view events, a Sega Genesis, a CD player, even if not the preferred brand, a very bratty thing of me to think back then. But by the time I got to middle school, I realized what others were provided, and this had me beginning to look at Jesus in terms of gimme, 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 please, son of God. I did go from wearing the same pairs of Wrangler jeans in middle school that got me mocked by some to Tommy Hilfiger and Polo by high school. So praise be to Jesus, a summer job, and my big sister swooping in to help me out. But one of the bigger, far less successful requests from me to Jesus was to cure me. As I got older and gaze grew in visibility, the Catholic Church and much of their Protestant brethren were becoming increasingly critical of homosexuals, their homosexual ways, and how homosexuals and their homosexual ways were spurring God's stress levels to bounce all across the universe. Such criticism was never lost on me, who couldn't help but notice this incredibly cute boy to the right of me, and his younger brother too. Phew. I knew early in life that I was drawn to boys more than to girls, but I learned just as early how such ways were frowned upon. What I had seen, heard, and learned haunted me. I wanted to change, and the only person I knew who could help me do so was Jesus. I convinced myself that he was going to change me, make me better. And by better, I mean straight. I was confident that it was going to happen. All I had to do was keep praying and wait. I was practically a walking commercial for those gay be gone groups who sing about the virtues of conversion therapy. I didn't know it then, but in hindsight, I can see that I was more in love with the idea of Jesus than anything else. Plus, I wasn't that good of a pal to Jesus. At first, Jesus was like the kid your mama forced you to play with. The kind you were initially indifferent to but then suddenly fawned over once you selfishly realized what they might be able to do for you. At the time, I thought I would do anything for Jesus because he was going to do everything for me eventually. at least so long as I kept pestering him about it while being a good Christian. The relationship was transactional yet substantive at the same time, because I needed to believe in someone better than everyone around me. I needed to believe things would get better. However, when met with the proposition of taking a more defined role in my religion and in church, I met it with equal parts befuddlement and resistance. That proposition came in the form of me being recruited for the priesthood. Yes, a priest scouted me, and when the opportunity presented itself, he hit me with a sales pitch on why I ought to consider making a white collar a permanent staple of my wardrobe. The priest in question was named Father Martin, or Father Marty, as he preferred to be called. He was an ex-Methodist music teacher turned Catholic priest. He was an older man, but there was something youthful to him if you look beyond his not-so-believable curly wig. That wig! It wasn't a jerry curl, because there were never any stains on his priest robes. But there were aesthetic similarities. Call it a second cousin of a jerry curl who didn't want to look as juicy. It was a perfect wig to wear if you were heading to a Rick James-themed costume party. Questionable tonsorial decisions notwithstanding, Father Marty was quite likable. He also made church a lot more interesting. When most black folks discovered that I was Catholic, their immediate reaction was, "Catholic mass is so boring." That's rude as fuck, but can I spot the lie? Not really. Catholic masses are very much about ritual, but many of those rituals and the performances of them are very Eurocentric. The pageantry is beautiful and traditional, but traditional for whom? This is why so many black Catholics went for the Protestants, whose services had far more pop to them. Perhaps being an ex-Methodist helped inform Father Marty's perspective, in that he could see swaths of black people at St. Mark the Evangelist Catholic Church who were present, but not totally present, in the current setup of mass there. That led Father Marty to help usher in a gospel choir, which livened up mass alongside his more engaging homilies. Around that same time, he also led attendance of the Spanish-only mass that took place 2 hours earlier every Sunday to follow suit with their own much-needed spins. That sort of inclusion was vital to the communities of these churches. Father Marty was one of the few black priests I had ever come across, and the only American-born black priest that I knew of back then. No wonder he was looking for someone like me to join him. He needed a friend, someone who understood the black American experience. Someone who knew the electric slide was not the descriptor for a specific kind of damage caused by the storm surges of a major hurricane. Someone who could play a game of pity pack. The blacks collectively played spades, but this was the game I was used to kinfolk and friends playing at get-togethers. The come work for Jesus moment took place during a routine confession. It was my first one since I had gone away for college, where for the first time in my life, I stopped attending church regularly. A wave of guilt came over me because of this, so while on a holiday break I had hoped to share this with Father Marty, then say 7 or 12 Hail Marys and feel better about myself. Confessions were always tricky. Ideally, you'd sit there, air out all of your sins to the priest operating as God's customer service rep, and then leave with a clean slate following those Hail Marys and acts of contrition. Unfortunately, the thing about Catholic guilt was that while it might have made you feel bad enough to want to go to confession, you might end up feeling too ashamed to actually confess all of your sins. Typically, Catholics would confess their sins behind a wall, but at St. Mark the Evangelist, you had to do a face-to-face, which made it even more difficult for me to open up. Normally, I would tell the priest a few things here and there, but never did I get blunt enough to blurt out something like, "Father Marty, I kept watching Cruel Intentions on tape, and fast forward into the part where Ryan Phillippe steps out of the pool butt-ass naked in order to masturbate." Yeah, that wasn't happening. What would happen was that Father Marty would hear me air a few sins, like cursing, and then we segue into short conversations about our religion. Father Marty felt that, despite my age, I was pretty knowledgeable about Christianity. He was also well aware of my mother's commitment to the church and how those values were being instilled in her children. Given that she wanted grandchildren, I imagine she never had any intention of pushing me that far into the faith. After all, I was an altar boy only once, and the request happened at the very last minute during a Saturday mass, for those who cannot attend on Sunday, for reasons spanning from work to NFL games. But to an aging priest constantly pestering parishioners to pray for vocations to the priesthood, I looked like a top seed in the priestly draft. Though at first I sat eye to eye in front of Father Marty and confessed the sins I didn't mind divulging, the small dimly lit beige room we were in began to feel smaller and darker as my confessional went on. I could tell in that moment that this wasn't going to be a routine confessional. The topic of which sins I may have committed shifted abruptly towards my take on those who committed their lives to God. I responded by saying individuals who choose to dedicate their lives to God ought to be commended for making the ultimate sacrifice. Translation, yes, it was very commendable and quite noble, but better them than me. Evidently, my response further piqued his interest, and for a few moments he sat there in silence, seemingly pondering over what to say next. He began to stare at me in the midst of this silence. It was as if he were searching for something inside of me, something that wouldn't lead to an investigation and a multi-million-dollar lawsuit and subsequent settlement later, mind you. He then questioned me about my age. I let him know that I was 20, otherwise known as the best time to start engaging in the worst sins. He claimed that I appeared more mature than my age suggested. He added that he could feel a strong sense of spirituality in me. He noted that in these trying times, God needed the most capable of servants. As we neared the end of my confessional, Father Marty looked at me and hit me with, "I see a priest in you." At that very moment, I felt my heart stop. I'm sure Father Marty and me breaking into Ave Maria or the choreography from Kirk Franklin's Stomp might have been a more festive reaction, but I opted for muted shock and awe instead. Muted because I was at church and couldn't yell, "You gotta be out of your rabbit-ass mind, Father." I guess hearing a religious person look at you and say you seem like a decent enough guy to serve God was quite the compliment. Yet all I did was question whether Father Marty suffered from cataracts or was starting to display early signs of dementia. How could he see a priest in me? Sure, I thought I knew a lot about Jesus and kept the recommended amount of Catholic guilt prescribed to parishioners, but me? A priest? At that period in my life, I saw my future self as something more along the lines of Katie Couric with a dick. She had co-anchors with penises, but as a long-time Today viewer, I preferred Katie over Brian Gumble, who seemed stiff and whose name select classmates would sometimes call me as a pejorative, and Matt Lauer, who often just came across as a dick. Now, I had no idea he was that bad, per the accusations that led to his surprise ouster, but good fuck of riddance all the same. Katie was both serious and fun, and I saw myself being the same on the morning news one day. Father Marty was convinced otherwise, saying he felt strongly about his suspicions and advised me to give real consideration to ultimately joining the priesthood. I was unsure as to whether he genuinely felt he saw a priest in me or he was simply filling my head with thoughts of joining so that he could produce his yearly goal of one parishioner to the priesthood. His follow-up question made me wonder if I was special or if he merely said this to any male of applicable age. He asked about college. I told him I was attending Howard University. "You should pledge Omega Psi Phi. I will pay for it." So not only did Father Marty see a priest in me, but he also saw a fraternity guy. And not just any frat. He saw me as a Q-dog. In terms of black fraternity and sorority stereotypes, I had been likened to an alpha because they were smart, or a kappa because they were considered to be the pretty boys, but never a Q. Granted, I did have a habit of sticking out my tongue while dancing, but most wouldn't have pegged me as the type to be stepping to George Clinton's atomic dog and barking. This is not an insult to them, because there were quite a few Qs that were on Howard's campus that I would have taken down. But yeah, no. I'm not sure whether Father Marty was a Q, but he did often wear a purple priest's robe, which might have been a shout out to that frat's colors. As I exited the confessional and proceeded to kneel before the pews to pray for forgiveness, I started to think of all the reasons I would not be right for the priesthood. First, profanity and I had been in a committed relationship since childhood. Second, while I had followed my mother's instructions to attend Mass up until I went off to D.C. for school, no way could I attend 7 times a week, much less perform it. Third, I was not a fan of uniforms. I just couldn't see myself dolled up in one of those priestly dresses they required to wear. I mean, I can appreciate how popes often dress like a bad bitch heading to an all-white party, but you know. Reasons 4 through forever. I was a virgin and not keen on the idea of committing to a life of celibacy. You can't give up sex before experiencing it a couple dozen times. I've never understood the requirement that priests and nuns be celibate anyway. The rationale for it is well known, but it doesn't make much sense all the same. Jesus never talked much about sex, so why was sex sold to us as impure and wrong outside of procreation? It was one of the many questions I used to have in catechism, but rarely if ever were those questions answered with anything other than the sentiment that it was God's way, which was shorthand for the hell if I know. Father Marty was seeing me in ways I couldn't see myself. He believed in me, And even if it was confounding, it was flattering. As a result, it made me stop and re-examine the image I was projecting to others. I mean, several years prior to that day, I had looked at another priest during Mass and daydreamed a bit about what it would be like to be him. Note that around that same time, I contemplated a career as Batman.